This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2016 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. I'm Chris Moore. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. In just a half hour, French horn player Brian Mangrum, the winner of the brass competition, is going to be playing Strauss's first horn concerto with the Aspen Conducting Academy Orchestra. So we're putting him at the very front of the line of the three people we're interviewing today. After that, Misha and Sipa Dichter for their Saturday concert. And finally, we'll talk to a member of the Emerson String Quartet, Eugene Drucker, about tonight's concert, which includes Brahms Quartet No. 2, the Berg Lyric Suite, and other pieces. First, let's talk with French horn player Brian Mangrum. Well, Brian, first of all, congratulations on winning the brass competition.
Well, thank you.
There were a lot of people. I saw a lot of the people competing against you because I was at the convocation. Okay. What are there, about 50 or 60 brass players all together in the
Something
program?
Like that, 19 horn players.
Mm-hmm. So. And today, the reason I'm putting you right up front here is because it's just after 3:30, and at 4 o'clock, the concert begins that you're going to be on with the Aspen Conducting Orchestra. Are you rehearsing with three different conductors for the three movements that you're playing?
Yes, one for each movement.
And it'll be interesting to see how unified the work is. At least there's not three horn players as well.
No, it's going to be weird because actually the second movement is supposed to lead right into the third movement, so they're mm-hmm. going to have to do a
quick switch on the podium,
yes, exactly.
Which I've seen them do several times, so that should yep. be great. Now, you were also up against trumpeters and euphoniums and tubas and trombones and other brass instruments, right?
Yeah, I don't think there were any euphoniums, but it was definitely trumpet, trombone, and other horn players.
And I want to ask about the horn itself. It's a very beautiful instrument, and the natural horn sounds so completely different. Have you played a natural horn where just the natural overtones come out and it sounds like a hunting horn?
Yes, I have. My little brother is also a horn player.
Mm-hmm.
And so for his, I think it was 12th birthday, my dad got us a natural horn.
Okay.
So we have one around the house. We fool around with.
And for this piece, of course, you'll be playing a modern French horn. And this is a Strauss work, the first horn concerto, which he wrote when he was 17 years old. And my understanding is that his father was a horn player as well, and he made this a little extra difficult for his dad.
Well, yeah, I've heard that story. I don't know exactly if that's the case, but it's definitely a fun piece.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nice to have early Strauss, which you can really hear. My teacher always says he's very influenced by Mendelssohn.
Are there some real challenges that are coming up, and especially at almost 8,000 feet? Does that create another challenge as well?
Yeah, I mean, at 8,000 feet, I have to add in a couple extra breaths.
Uh-huh.
And, challenges is just getting through the piece.
This is a piece that's very upbeat. It's not like his Death and Transfiguration or something.
It's definitely a fun, light piece. It's not quite as profound as his second concerto, which he wrote later on in his life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can tell he's a young guy writing this.
Do you feel that because you're only a few years apart in age from the age that he was when he wrote it, that you feel kind of a natural connection to this work?
I guess, yeah. It's a little easier to connect with.
Is there a story in your case about how you picked up the French horn and not the clarinet or not the piano or some other instrument?
Yes, there is, actually. I started off on violin, and when I was 12 years old, well, actually, I was 11 years old in my summer camp, my chamber music coach was a horn player.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, I walked in on him practicing, and he let me try his horn. And
mm-hmm.
I played Mary Had a Little Lamb. So that entire year, I pestered my dad to buy me a horn.
Mm-hmm.
After quite a while, when it became apparent that it wasn't just a phase, my dad actually went and rented a French horn from Twig Music in Montreal,
mm-hmm.
and I started playing. So yeah, that took a year.
And how old were you when that was happening?
It was 11 when I had my first, official horn lesson.
What is it about that a young person that young, suddenly decides, this is the instrument for me, even though you had been, in a sense, guided towards the violin, but then all of a sudden it's like, no, I want the French horn.
Well, really, that's a short answer. I really love the sound of the instrument.
Tell me a little bit more about the sound. There's an enormous range of sounds when you say the sound of the instrument. Is it the range of different kinds of sounds that you like as well?
I think it's a very rich sound.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you can modify the sound to, suit whatever mood you're playing in. You can change the sound of most instruments, but I feel like the horn is the one that has the widest range in that regard.
I look forward to hearing you play the Strauss and giving us a great interpretation of it.
Well, thank you. I'm excited about it.
If you've just joined us, this is Festival Showcase, and we've been talking with French horn player Brian Mangrum, who will be playing in just about a half hour over at the tent. So head over, hear the Aspen Conducting Academy Orchestra right now if you'd like to hear the guy you've just been listening to play his French horn. Now we're going to go to Misha and Sipa Dichter, duo pianists, who will be playing this Saturday some music of Schubert and other great composers. Misha and Sipa Dichter, the two of you are truly regulars here at the Aspen Music Festival. People really enjoy the concerts and the performances, and there just aren't that many chances to hear piano four hands and two piano performances as well. So we want to welcome you back to Aspen and thank you for taking a little time to talk to us a bit about this unique kind of piano playing.
It's our pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
The first thing that comes to mind is when I think of pianists, I think of how pianists tend to play alone. If you go to a jazz bar or something or whatever, a club, that there's just a pianist playing background music, or even if a pianist is playing with an orchestra, in a sense you're alone, or if you're playing like a string quintet or piano quintet, you're alone. But when the two of you play together, it's a whole different energy, I guess you might say. Is it more challenging inherently for pianists to learn how to play together than, say, string players? It would seem with the attack, you'd have to be very precise, for example.
You've covered just about everything I can say, because I like to say that one piano four hands or two pianos with two pianists is closer to string quartet playing than just about anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And we cannot stand the sound of pianists getting together for the first time just for the fun of it and reading through four hands, because the amount of detail that has to be worked out and that cannot possibly be done on the spot is mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we always say it really is like working on a four-hand piece. It will be the equivalent of a string quartet, because mm-hmm. we really have to think in those terms, in terms of balance and everything dynamic and breathing together. And, you know, I really think it's something that comes from years of being together.
And I would like to also state what is not the obvious to the listener. Two people sitting side by side at one piano have to completely change the weight of everything. Think about it. If I come from playing a solo piano sonata where my right hand is the singing top voice, suddenly I'm in the bass of a four-hand piece, and my right hand would be the equivalent of a viola line.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily the singing or prominent line. So my right side has to recede a bit, while the left hand has to be the bass for both of us.
Now, the two of you are playing in Harris Hall, and the last time you came to Aspen, I had a chat with Joan Harris, who is an amateur pianist, and she and a friend of hers thought it would be fun to get together and play piano four hands together. And her friend couldn't stand it. It was too close. The space issues were a lot. It must help that the two of you are married, or at least if two pianists are very, very good friends or family or something, because it really is a terrible invasion of space in some ways, isn't it?
You see a lot of siblings that play together
mm-hmm.
in married couples. Yes, I really think it makes a difference.
Obviously, for the two of you, it's easy after all these years. And when you come to Aspen, do you spend some time choosing the pianos that you want, or do they just
yes.
roll out two pianos and that's what you play?
Yes, well, we have the luxury of 12 hours after our choosing of the pianos playing the concert, so yes.
And do the two of you still play with symphony orchestras, and do you still work with conductors, or are you mostly...
Yes, I'm okay. going after Aspen to Chicago to play with the Chicago Symphony, so yes, at least a dual life, and of course I play a lot of chamber music, and Sipa and I play four hands and two pianos.
I'm curious, has your dynamic with conductors changed over the years as you mature as an artist?
Yes, because there was this period right after I got my Moscow Tchaikovsky Prize in 66, I went right out and played with, you know, Leinsdorf and Ormandy and Bernstein and Giulini, and I was just loving learning so much from these people. Pretty much nodded a lot, saying, oh, yes,
mm-hmm.
of course, maestro. And now that I'm 70, I've got a bit of a past here. And just the other day, when I mentioned Chicago Symphony, I'm playing with David Zinman, who used to be Aspen's music director.
Mm-hmm.
And he lives now near our country house, about a mile away. And we're doing the Bernstein Age of Anxiety, which is otherwise Bernstein's big piano concerto. And we had a little piano run-through yesterday. And I was thinking, well, you know, David is still the old master, and I listen to every...
Mm-hmm.
a kernel of wisdom and gained for it. But if some young whippersnapper comes up and says, do this or do that, he's not going to have a chance with me.
Right. The other thing, too, is that that was a time pre-YouTube, pre-MTV, etc. Yeah. And it seems like at that time, how you sounded, what you conveyed and expressed through the piano was most important. And now there seems to be so much of an emphasis on visual, even when it comes to just pure symphonic music or something like that. And I wanted to ask if you feel lucky, because neither of you are the type that flails around at the piano. You express, there's a lot of emotion in the expression of your music, and I can really be carried away by your performance, but it's not like watching you is the excitement. It's hearing what you play.
I think I'm going to take the fifth on that, or whatever amendment.
Okay, I think she's backing out of this, but you've absolutely nailed it, and I'm very touched that you know it so well. You know, we come from a Russian school of playing and teaching, as exemplified by our teacher at Juilliard, Rosina Levine, who was a gold medalist at the Moscow Conservatory in the end of the 19th century. And she used to say that you have to play things so visually simply that people should just only avail themselves to what they hear, not be distracted at all by what they see. And she said it's got to look so simple that after watching you play, they think, this is so easy, I'm going to try it myself, and let them try. Aha.
Right.
So I'm glad you picked up on that. And Sipa has been on my case a bit, but then we're both very similar that way. She says people don't get what you're feeling, and I say, well, if they close their eyes, they'll get it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to use a terrible metaphor, which is, I love tennis. I love to watch tennis. And you always hear the commentators saying, he should show more emotion. You know, he should smile. I actually heard the commentator saying, you know, in an incredibly difficult match, he should smile more. And I thought, you know, it's all over. It's in every endeavor, as you say. It has become so visual.
Mm-hmm.
It is a different world. Yes, it's the world of YouTube. Yes.
And that is probably less of a problem for you, too, because you have an established career, and so maybe it would be more of a challenge for you if you were just rising in the ranks as 20-somethings.
Not coming out of the training we had, which was, you know, you don't have to flail around. All the
right
sound comes right from there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's really, we're the result of our training, and I really respect very much the two schools that I came from, the German. My teacher in California was a Schnabel pupil, and then Levine with the Grand Romantic Russian tradition. Actually, I did have a little showdown with Mrs. Levine when she was about 86 years old, and I was starting with her. And at the end of some Brahms rhapsody, she said, you know, dear, it's the end of the piece. You can throw your hands a bit. And she had a wonderful swivel chair that she sat in during lessons. So I said, Mrs. Levine, do you mind if I just turn you around facing backwards, and I'll do it your way with the hands flying up, and then I'll do it my way with just producing the sound with a chord right there at the keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
And she, you know, in her infinite wisdom said, you know, dear, I can't hear the difference.
Mm-hmm.
But years later, I realized that she had a point, that we are also animals that are seen, and you've got to give people an idea that you're involved. So we may do a little bit of that.
Right.
I mean, there have been study about people watching different behavior, and the audience actually thought that the one who moved around more, showed more, however you want to describe it, they were more touched by it. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it was the same pianist. So
mm-hmm.
the power of suggestion is so incredible. We just can't dismiss it.
We are visual animals.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And I enjoy
much
watching.
On a higher level, I would like to mention that we're extremely proud, totally unrelated to what we're talking about now. Our younger son, who's now 43, just visited Aspen to participate in the Ideas Festival.
Oh, my goodness.
And now our family has gone on to new realms.
I mean, mm-hmm. he came to Aspen for the first time when he was 9 months old.
That's fabulous.
And then came every summer for, I don't know, 20 years probably.
And as they grew up there, because we used to spend weeks every summer, they always considered Aspen magic land. So for him to come back as this respected person out there in the real world, makes his parents very proud.
No doubt. What is the, just out of curiosity, what is the subject that he was speaking on?
He works for a nonprofit called Acumen, which in a short sentence tackles poverty all over the world. They invest with entrepreneurs who are trying to solve world poverty. It's an amazing organization, and they have helped the lives of, I know, 50 million people or 80 million people in Pakistan and India. It's very successful, and he was invited to participate in a panel about, it's called Impact Investing.
That's really wonderful to know. I had no idea about that. I was just about to lead up to saying a little bit about the visual element, which is, Misha, I understand you're a cartoonist. I've only seen one of your cartoons, but is that something that you're still dabbling in, or something that you're is kind of a side profession, as it were?
Well, not a side profession. I do have, you can get on Amazon, my digital cartoon book that captures about 40 years of touring and playing with conductors and things. I just made a cartoon for a friend the other day, so I can still do it. No, I love the idea of having a thought and just getting a fine point pen and making just a line drawing of something. It's a nice release and very, very liberating for me because I have no formal training in it. Drawing is something that just literally flows out of my hand, and then I go back to the piano and I have all these layers of understanding that I must confront, but not with drawing.
Sipa, I wonder if there are things that have nothing to do with music that you enjoy as well.
I love yoga. That's how I get away from everything. Mm-hmm. And I do that 2 or 3 times a week. And we used to run, and I just walk. And I'm a cook. I'm a good cook. So those are my...
Uh-huh.
He sees everything that's on and off Broadway every year.
Watch out for what you just said there, because a lot of friends are going to be inviting themselves over for dinner now, no doubt.
Well, they know. The real fans know.
Right. On your Saturday program, you have a work of Schubert's, and there have been times when I've heard you play Schubert before. I know you must love him. And I wonder if either of you consider yourselves religious people or something, because when I hear you play Schubert, I feel something. I don't know how to describe it. That takes me to a place that is more than just enjoying the emotions or the beauty of the music.
I couldn't have said it better. That's absolutely, I have chills thinking of that, because I've said to people, you know, I had Jewish training until my bar mitzvah and then I left it all behind.
Mm-hmm.
What I feel when I connect as a listener or as a performer with a piece has to be something approximating some inner peace that religion gives people.
Mm-hmm.
This Schubert continues to give us goosebumps after all these years. I think Schubert does it for me almost more than any composer.
Mm-hmm. Sipa, do you have any more to add to that?
Misha said it well. We are not religious, but I think music could almost be described as our religion. You know, that's how we get to our innermost feelings and project that and share with people and hope that they are feeling the same. So I think this feeling of community, feeling something, it's very similar to religion.
Let's talk about some of the other pieces that you have on the program. There's one here, the Andalusian Dances, which I don't think I've heard that particular piece before.
Yeah, I think Infante is a one-hit wonder with that.
I see.
You know, it's funny. My first 18 years were spent in Los Angeles, and there used to be a program in the afternoon on the local KFAC classical station called Piano Personalities. And there would be this, coming from the base of the piano, this arpeggio going up, and this Spanish, da-dum, pam, pa-da-dum, pa-pa-pa-pam. And for years, I thought, what is this piece? And then we were strolling years later, Steve and I, after we were married, strolling in Paris, and there was this little store on the river with a red sign saying Musique, and we walked in. And there in some dusty bins of old, used music, I opened this thing up, and I saw, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I thought, that's it! I never knew, because we couldn't, in those days, you didn't have Google search. We bought the music probably in the 70s, and have been playing it ever since. It's so beautiful.
It's great, yeah.
You were talking about how when your kids were kids, and they were saying that Aspen is magic land. Do you still feel a little bit about that, or could you share maybe some stories of some of your favorite times that you've had up here in Aspen as part of the festival?
God, there's so many layers. See?
Yeah, well, you know, our children growing up being New Yorkers and all their friends went to sleepaway camp, and they couldn't understand what was that, because they came to Aspen for the summer. That's where they learned to swim, to play tennis. They came to concerts, and they're both very successful professionally. Our older son is a PhD in clinical psychology, And it was very formative for them. They really loved it. It was a simpler Aspen. There were no fancy stores, and there was Tom's supermarket, and we wore blue jeans all the time. Mm-hmm. And we had these magic summers with barbecues, with horseback riding. They just thought that that's what everybody did during the summer.
A memory just flashed to mind to pull together the thought of several minutes ago of our now 43-year-old speaking there. I remember he was about 1.5, and we took him to the tent. He was sound asleep, and I was sitting at the back, and I remember Lee Luvisi was playing the Emperor Concerto, and our little 1-year-old was asleep on my shoulder, and then he started to snore, and Lee was approaching the slow movement. I thought, to wake the child or not, well, the story is becoming unbearable, so I woke him in the slow movement. He went, I went running up the back of the tent, and here we are 43 years later.
And you hope that doesn't happen in your concert.
Oh, God. But they, you know, that was the best part of it, that when they were kids, it wasn't guys put on something nice and we're going to take you to a concert at Carnegie Hall, which is the big formal deal. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we'd have houses just 2 blocks from the Meadows, and we'd just come from playing tennis or something, and we were all going out to dinner later, and we would walk over and hear the Verdi Requiem, and that was just normal for them.
I remember stumbling into you, Misha, on a hike. I think it was up to American Lake. But it's a not completely insignificant hike. Did the two of you do fairly significant hikes while you were up here in Aspen too?
I was dragged kicking and screaming.
Yeah, Misha was dragged. I used to love, oh God, I used to love hiking. But yeah, no, Misha was dragged. And again, our son, this one who was just there, he used to have a friend from Aspen, and they used to run up the Ute Trail.
Oh my gosh.
And he was, you know, just there, and he said, I walked it up. It was very hard.
Well, I want to thank you both for taking this time to share with us, and we look forward to hearing you play some beautiful music with all four of your hands, all 20 fingers.
Okay. It's been a pleasure. Thank you. We look forward to going back.
We've been talking with pianists Misha and Sipa Dichter, and now we're going to jump right over to the Emerson String Quartet. Eugene Drucker talked to me a little bit about their program that is coming up this evening at Harris Concert Hall.
Most of our celebration in this coming season will focus on performance rather than recording, so I can just list a couple of things. At the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, we're going to play 2 concerts in October, and it's, of course, significant to us because our longtime cellist, David Finkel, who I know is a big figure in Aspen, continues to be, even though he left the quartet 3 years ago, is the artistic director of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, along with his wife, Wu Han. Mm-hmm. And David will join us for the Schubert Cello Quintet in the second concert. We're also going to play the Mendelssohn Octet with one of our protege groups, the Calidor Quartet, which has been working with us for the past couple of years at Stony Brook, and that is perhaps an increasing focus of our activity, which is trying to pass on what we've learned to younger generations of quartet. And at the end of this coming season, the end of the 40th anniversary for us, we'll have a concert at Carnegie Hall with Maurizio Pollini, in which we'll play the Brahms Piano Quintet, mm-hmm. and the first half we'll play works by Berg and Ravel. And in between, well, there are concerts in a lot of the capitals that have been meaningful to us in the course of our career, Vienna, London, there are many others, of course, Copenhagen, I think, Berlin, Cologne, Germany, for example. So we're really just continuing in the Emerson tradition of trying to play a large body of repertoire as well as we can and make interesting combinations of pieces.
I hope that you all like cake and champagne, because I know that the whole world is going to want to celebrate with you over the course of this 40th anniversary. But seriously, I wonder if you, in the course of all these travels, if part of the joy of all of that is going to be all the friendships you've made over the decades as well.
Yes, of course that's part of it. I mean, it has been part of it in an ongoing sense. And to the extent that round numbers are important, we'll continue these relationships with presenters, with some of whom we have strong personal ties, with almost all of them, practically without exception. We're on friendly terms, even if we haven't gotten to know them that well personally, but there's a goodly number of presenters with whom we've shared a lot of social occasions as well. So yes, we appreciate the fact that people feel that our 40th anniversary season is something to celebrate. You know, for us, of course, it's part of the continuum. We're looking ahead to the future as well.
The first time I interviewed you was 38 years ago. I've had a sense of a growth or a very gradual and subtle change in the sound of the Emerson Quartet. Of course, the big change when David Finkel left, the sound change had to change there because you now have a whole other musician. But beyond that, how do you feel that the quartet has changed and how it's evolved in terms of your approach to the music that you perform since 35 or 40 years ago?
It's hard to be objective about what we do, and just like when you look at yourself in the mirror, you don't see a radical change, whereas somebody who hasn't seen you for 25 years might see the change that you're no longer aware of, except in a general sense, you know, that everybody changes in appearance as they get older. Mm-hmm. Similarly, with our playing, things have probably changed, and it's hard to put that succinctly into words. We've continued to look for a channel of personal expression in the great repertoire that we've played through all these decades, and we probably have changed our sound without even trying to. You know, we've mm-hmm. all gone through different instruments over the years and maybe either refined or just somehow redefined on an unconscious level what we're looking for in a string sound as individuals, and then, of course, that will affect the collective sound as we come together. I'm always looking for depth in sound. You want a sparkle, of course, so it really depends on the character, not only of the entire work, let's say the character of Mozart as composed, as opposed to Brahms, but also within each work. There's any great work of art is going to have a fair amount of contrast mm-hmm. in it. So there's tonal contrast within a quartet of Bartok, Beethoven. We expect that because of the extremes of contrast that were sort of part of Beethoven's outsized personality. But even within Haydn and Mozart, you might think of them as being on a slightly smaller scale, but they were constantly experimenting, and you'll come across passages that have different textures, different sound colors, and different moods. So we're always trying to adapt our sound to the demands of the music at the moment. So that might be a constant in terms of process, but the manifestation, what comes across to the audience, may indeed have changed over the years. And this box set that has come out, well, I've got it at home, but I haven't opened it yet. and I don't know when I'll have the time and patience to sit and listen to it from the beginning all the way through up until almost the present. But I imagine I would hear a difference in the recorded sound, and we can extrapolate from that a difference in the performance sound as well. So I would hope that something has matured in mm-hmm. the sound and in the rhythmic pacing. I am aware of a certain change that has occurred after Paul Watkins joined the group. He and David are both marvelous cellists, and they have wonderful sounds. If I had to sum it up in a few words, I would say that Paul's sound tends to be a little bassier, a little deeper, and David's sounds a little more tenor, or baritone at least, let's call it that, mm-hmm. Baritone to tenor range, and very beautiful in a completely different way. So since the cello sound provides the foundation for the sound of the whole quartet, that will automatically change. And probably our pacing has changed a little bit also. We might have, without losing much of the edge that we had before, I think that we might have a little bit more expansive approach to timing issues than we had before.
We've been talking with Eugene Drucker of the Emerson String Quartet. His concert with his other three colleagues will be taking place tonight at Harris Concert Hall. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2016 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Please join me Tuesdays at 3:30 or the rebroadcast Saturdays at 3 for more interviews. My name is Chris Moore. Thanks for listening.